it's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
Well, maybe not. Maybe that spoonful of sugar is the very reason that we need medication. Walk into any convenience store or supermarket today, and sugar seems to be the key ingredients in most of what we eat. At the same time, obesity is reaching epic proportions. Its personal and public policy ramifications touch everything from healthcare costs to educational success. But is sugar really the culprit in all of this? Our guest today, Dr. Robert Lustig, thinks so. Dr. Robert Lustig is an internationally renowned pediatric endocrinologist. He is the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Programs at UCSF's Benioff Children's Hospital. He's a member of the UCSF Center for Obesity Assessment and the author of a new book entitled Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Dr. Robert Lustig, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Are we being too narrow in our focus when we look to sugar as really the primary culprit in some of the medical and obesity problems that we're facing today?
Let me make this very clear to your audience. It is not just sugar that causes obesity. There are many things that cause obesity. Mozafarian at the Harvard School of Public Health last year in the New England Journal took apart our diet and determined that of all the different various foodstuffs that we have, the thing that made the most weight gain was potato chips and French fries. So, you know, there are lots and lots of things that cause weight gain. What I'm talking about is what takes obesity, which in and of itself is not particularly disease-related and not particularly problematic other than cosmetically, and turns it into metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is that cluster of diseases, diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, stroke, heart disease, cancer, dementia, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, polycystic ovarian disease, all the diseases that travel with obesity. Here's the thing. 20% of obese people have completely normal metabolism. They will live a completely normal life, and they will just die of something else. Their obesity is irrelevant, and they will and their lifespan is not cut short. Conversely, up to 40% of normal weight people harbor that same chronic metabolic dysfunction that the obese do. They're just not obese, and they're going to die of their hypertension or their type 2 diabetes or their heart disease. And the problem is that these people don't even know they're sick. So this is not a problem of obesity. This is a problem of abnormal metabolism. And that is where sugar comes in.
And where sugar comes in that the molecules of fructose themselves are poisonous to us, essentially.
Well, that's been my thesis on this. And the reason that I came to this thesis is, number one, there is not one biochemical reaction in the body that requires fructose, not one. There is only one place in the body that has fructose, and it's semen, but you don't get the fructose in semen from your diet. You actually get it from conversion of glucose to fructose via the aldose reductase pathway. And that's number one. And number two, the way fructose is handled in the liver is exactly the same way that alcohol is handled within the liver. And when you consume excess alcohol, you know what you get. You get fatty liver, you get scarring, you get insulin resistance, you get cirrhosis, you get all those diseases that we associate with chronic alcoholism. Well, guess what? Fructose gives you the exact same diseases. To a T. And the reason is because the metabolism of fructose is identical, not even close, just identical to that of alcohol. The big difference between alcohol and fructose is that for alcohol, the yeast does the first step of metabolism called glycolysis. For fructose, we do our own first step. But once though the substrate reaches the mitochondria, and the mitochondria have to burn it for energy, and they can't burn it because they're overwhelmed and they're overloaded with excess energy, and they have no choice but to turn it into liver fat. The mitochondria don't care where the substrate came from. They don't care if it came from alcohol or from fructose. The bottom line is, You overloaded them, and you're going to pay the price.
And talk
that
about
is what we're seeing.
And talk about the way that works, the way that transfers from the overload in the liver to the impact that it has on our brain and our desire for more sugar and more
That's
food.
Right. So what happens is, our research has shown that the higher your insulin levels go in your blood, the less well your brain can see the signals for satiety, in particular the hormone leptin. Leptin is a hormone that's made by your fat cells, goes to your brain, and tells your brain, you know what? I've had enough. I don't need to eat so much, and I can burn energy at a normal rate and feel good. And when you're in good health, you're leptin sensitive, your leptin levels are low, your brain can see it, and you feel good, and you can stay thin. However, as your insulin levels go up, your brain sees the leptin signal less and less well, and your brain, when it can't see the leptin, it thinks that the periphery must be starving. There's not enough energy on board because it's not getting the signal. And so that's going to make you eat more, and it's going to make you exercise less in an attempt to try to bring on extra energy and conserve it. So you know what we call that? We call that gluttony and sloth. So it turns out that the higher the insulin goes, the worse the behaviors become. So what makes insulin go up? Refined carbohydrate and sugar. So refined carbohydrate and sugar are the big bad guys in this story. I'm not the first person to say this.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Taub said it in his book, Why We Get Fat. What I'm saying is that the thing that turns it to metabolic syndrome, the thing that makes all of those diseases, the thing that causes $192 billion a year to go down a rat hole in terms of medical expenditures that do nothing to help society, that's sugar.
To what extent does this become chronic, and what is the body's ability to reset itself?
Unfortunately, not very well, and it is a big problem. There is some capacity for healing. It takes a very long time. It is not quick. In addition, there are a lot of people who are sugar addicted. In the same way that they might be nicotine or cocaine addicted, and they really probably need something that would be akin to sugar rehab. We see it in our clinic all the time. We have kids who are sugar addicted, and worse yet, we have parents who are sugar addicted who can't get the sugar out of the house to help the kid. And that's one of the reasons why things continue to be a problem, especially in difficult families. What we tell them is that it's just like any other addiction. It takes 3 weeks to be able to sort of get rid of the biochemical problem in the brain that's fomenting the addiction, but it can continue to be a problem for up to 5 years.
And how does that addiction work? Is it the same as other kinds of addiction, drug addiction, alcohol addiction?
I think it's very much like alcohol addiction. Now, look, there are certain drugs that we know about that are enormously addictive. For instance, heroin, morphine, cocaine. These are very highly addictive drugs. We also have some drugs that are a little bit less addictive, like nicotine. And then we have some drugs that are addictive only in certain populations and not in others. A perfect example of that would be alcohol. So we know that there are alcohol addicts. They're called alcoholics. But not everybody's an alcoholic, and plenty of people can drink socially with no problem. You know, plenty of people have a glass of wine a day, and it's perfectly fine, and I think that's fine too. And God knows, my wife has, her glass of red wine every night, and I support it, and it's not a problem. But there are clearly some people who can't, and I think the same thing goes for sugar. Who those people are, how we determine, how to diagnose them, and what best to do about them, that's, for further research.
Right. And one of the broader points that you make is that all of this goes against everything that we have been told about nutrition and eating for the past 30 years in this country.
Well, everything that we currently believe, not me, but everything that we, the collective we, believe stems from one major fallacy, one dogma, which unfortunately is not true. And that dogma is a calorie is a calorie. If you eat more than you burn, you'll gain weight. If you eat less than you burn, you'll lose weight. A calorie is a calorie, therefore eat less, exercise more. Which means that the two phenomena, gluttony and sloth, they are behaviors, and therefore they are primary, and therefore it's your fault. So if you believe a calorie is a calorie, then you believe eat less, exercise more, and you believe it's your fault. I do not. I basically take the exact opposite tech.
How did we come to this idea of the body being this closed system, calories in, calories out?
Well, because the first law of thermodynamics is inviolate. The first law of thermodynamics is a law. I believe in the first law. I subscribe to the first law. You know, to be honest with you, if I didn't subscribe to the first law, you know, my entire medical profession would have railroaded me out on a rail. The point is, not is the first law the problem. It's not. It's the question of what's the interpretation of that law. Because as you know, the Supreme Court often finds different interpretations in laws. Here's the two interpretations. Ready?
Go ahead.
If you eat it, you better burn it, or you're going to store it. That's the standard interpretation of the first law. In which case, then, if you eat it, that's a behavior, and you don't burn it, that's a behavior, then you're going to store it. That's a biochemical process. In other words, the behavior causes the biochemistry. There's another interpretation to the first law. Ready?
Go ahead.
If you're going to store it, and you expect to burn it, then you're going to have to eat it. Okay? If you're going to store it, that is high insulin levels driving excess energy deposition, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, because energy expenditure and quality of life are synonymous. Things that make your energy expenditure go up make you feel good, like, for instance, ephedrine, it's off the market, caffeine for 2 hours, exercise. Things that make your energy expenditure go down make you feel lousy, like hypothyroidism, starvation. So if you're going to store it and you expect to burn it, then you're going to have to eat it. And now the biochemical process of weight gain from high insulin is primary, and the behaviors of gluttony and sloth are secondary to the biochemical process. The biochemistry comes first. And as a neuroendocrinologist, as a neuroscientist, as someone who studied behavior for 6 years at Rockefeller University, I can categorically state without any question that there is no such thing as behavior. There is only biochemistry. Sometimes we're not smart enough to understand what that biochemistry is, but it's always biochemistry.
And in that fundamental idea that a calorie is not a calorie, the calories are fundamentally different, what
That's right.
role then does genetics play in how our bodies interpret that?
Right. We're still learning about this, and we don't really know, and probably different genetics makeups, you know, allow for different processing of calories in different fashions. There are, for instance, Latinos where that when they consume sugar, they get more fatty liver than anybody else. In fact, Latinos, that 45% of Latinos today have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And there's a protein in the liver called PNPLA3. And if you have the wrong genetic complement for that protein, a little sugar is going to make you very sick. And that is one of the reasons we're seeing so much fatty liver and diabetes in Latinos today. And that's very important. So genetics can play a role. Same thing in African Americans in terms of diabetes. There may be certain things that actually put you at greater predisposition for certain diseases based on your genetics. But the bottom line is, you still need the environmental insult. We can't change genetics. We can, if we chose to, change environment. At this point in time, without a genetic fix, all we have is change the environment. That's called public health.
It's public health, and it really is a fundamental change in the kind of diets we eat, with a greater focus on what you talk about, which is the more fiber in the diet.
Right. So that's the big issue. Fiber is one of the best things in our diet, and the food industry pulls it out. And they pull it out very specifically for their own purposes, because you can't freeze fiber. Go home, take an orange, put it in your freezer overnight, take it out, put it on the counter, thaw it, try to eat it, see what you get. What do you get? You get mush. Why do you get mush? Because the ice crystals form inside the cell wall, macerate the cell wall, so that when the orange thaws, all the water rushes in, turns the thing to mush. Hey, food industry knows that. But if you squeeze it and freeze it, it lasts forever. Right? It's a commodity now. Storable food, frozen concentrated orange juice. can sell it on the market. You can, you know, you can make money off it. No depreciation. Lots of money to be made. So the bottom line is removal of fiber from processed food is a wonderful thing for the food industry in terms of them making money. The problem is that fiber was necessary for our health. Because what fiber does is it limits the rate of absorption from the gut into the bloodstream. It acts as a secondary barrier. It acts as like a gel on the inside of your intestine so that your liver doesn't get overflooded with all of this sugar and all this refined carbohydrate all at once, so that your liver doesn't turn it into liver fat and it can stay healthy. Problem is, we don't have any fiber because the food industry removed it.
And it's interesting that, nature kind of understands that, and you use the fruit analogy in that the reason for the juice, which is equally bad, is to provide a delivery system for the fiber.
Correct. It's the fiber that's the good part of the fruit. The juice is the bad part of the fruit. The juice is nature's way of getting you to eat your fiber. Problem is, what we're doing is we're turning them into smoothies. So everybody says, well, smoothies, they've got the whole fruit in it, right? No, they don't, not anymore. There are two kinds of fiber. There's insoluble fiber, the stringy stuff, the cellulose, you know, like the like celery. And then there's the soluble fiber, which is like the pectins, you know, the things that hold jelly together. You need both. And the problem is that when you juice a fruit, the pectins are still there, but the insoluble fiber is sheared to smithereens. It can't do its job. Its job is to create like a latticework on the inside of your intestine for the soluble fiber to then plug the holes. And so you create this secondary barrier. And you can actually see it on electron microscopy. So it is it's very cool. And when you consume both soluble and insoluble together, you get the benefits. Problem is, processed food doesn't have both. It has sometimes it has soluble fiber because they add it, you know, like all the fiber-containing, you know, cereals. That's all soluble fiber. Insoluble fiber they can't add. The only way to get that is real food.
As we look around the world and see other nations and their diets, what do we learn from that experience?
They're all eating what we eat, and they all now have the same obesity problem and the same metabolic syndrome problem that we have. That's what we learn. We learn that this is not an American problem. This is a global problem. This is a problem everywhere. And last year, the UN Secretary General announced that non-communicable disease, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, etc., was now a bigger problem to the developing world, not the developed world, the developing world, than is acute infectious disease, including HIV. And they're going to start diverting resources to now take care of these diseases in other countries because they're chewing through their health care expenditures faster than we are because they don't even have as much money. This is going to bankrupt the world. This is the single biggest public health crisis in the history of the world. It puts the Black Plague to shame. And the problem is the food industry is making out like a bandit.
How does the role of fat play a part in this process?
So the big question is fat good or bad? Depends on who you talk to. Some people will tell you fats are good, like the Atkins people. Obviously, the vegan people will tell you fats are bad. I come down very much in the middle. I think it depends which fat. In the same way, a calorie is not a calorie, a carbohydrate is not a carbohydrate, an amino acid is not an amino acid, and to be honest with you, a fat is not a fat. There are seven classes of fats. There's omega-3s, which are heart-healthy and will save your life. On the other end of the spectrum, there's trans fats, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the devil incarnate. They're poison, and they will kill you, and they will kill you relatively rapidly. They're both 9 calories per gram. They're both fats, but clearly one will save your life, and the other one is poison. And then you have all the fats in between. You have monounsaturates, which are pretty darn good for you. They stimulate transcription factors in the liver that are helpful. You have polyunsaturates, which for the most part are good, but can actually cause some immune dysfunction if you overdo them. You have saturated fat, which is likely neutral in terms of cardiovascular disease and is really just a method for getting fat around the body from one organ to another. It's neither good nor bad. It's probably cardiovascularly neutral. Then you have medium-chain triglycerides, which can cause a problem in certain patients. And then you have omega-6s, which are pro-inflammatory, and you need some inflammatory fats because your immune system requires them, but if you have too many, then the inflammation goes haywire and actually helps contribute to heart disease. And then you have trans fat. So guess what? A fat is not a fat. Depends what you're eating. So is fat good? Some are.
I want to come back to kids, which is something you've been working on primarily, and what we're seeing as these kids grow up and the long-term impact of this.
The long-term impact is disastrous. We are seeing type 2 diabetics in 8 to 10-year-olds now, and actually we are very concerned about it. We have data which actually shows that sugar is causative to diabetes, not correlative. Causative. We know that sugar actually causes type 2 diabetes, and children never had type 2 diabetes before. They have it now. We know that this is causation, and we are actually starting a nonprofit organization here in San Francisco to actually start dealing with this process and actually getting ready to take this straight to the food industry through the courts.
What has been the response of the food industry to your work?
You know, it's very interesting. Immediately and directly, they are very quiet, and I find that very, very strange. You would think that they would be all over me. Problem is the science, and if they want to attack me, they're going to have to attack the science, because I only speak science, and they haven't attacked the science. What they do instead is they attack me. Because, you know, if you can discredit the messenger, you know, then whatever the message is, you know, goes by the wayside. So they are doing their best to discredit me. I am now on Koch's enemies list, which I take as a badge of courage. I find that that's actually a good thing, not a bad thing. But the bottom line is the food industry has to change, and they don't want to change because they're making money hand over fist. This is their juggernaut. And when we went from regular fat to low fat back in the early 1980s, and they learned that they could add sugar to all these foods, and that they could actually make more money, this, you know, this is now their juggernaut. And I've have it on good authority from a major food industry executive who will remain nameless for the moment. Here's what he said to me. He said this to me last year. He said, "We know we have a problem. And we could change. We changed back in the 1980s. We could fix this problem, but with two provisos. Number one, we won't go it alone. And number two, we can't lose money." That's what he told me. That's a direct quote from a major food industry executive from a company you've heard of. They know they have a problem. They know they need to change, but they won't. Because they can't lose money, and they're too afraid of their stockholders.
Dr. Robert Lustig, the book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Doctor, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
No, my pleasure, Mr. Sheckman.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.